how other musical traditions have become entwined. Join me for Anushka Shankar's Journey Through Indian Classical Music continues tonight at 11 with the first two episodes on BBC Sounds.
It's midday and next, Private Passions, and Michael Barclay's guest is the science writer and broadcaster, Dr. Kat Arney.
Gone, thankfully, are the days when cancer couldn't even be mentioned, and just as well, since about half of us will develop cancer at some point. As the treatments and drugs improve, so does our knowledge of what causes it. All this is what makes the work of my guest today, Dr. Kat Arney, so fascinating, and her latest award-winning book, Rebel Cell, Cancer, Evolution, and the Science of Life, will completely change the way you think about cancer. After a PhD in genetics at Cambridge University, Kat Arney worked for 10 years as science communications manager at Cancer Research UK, and then she left that job to go freelance, writing books and newspaper articles about science, broadcasting, and podcasting. You may well have heard her recent Radio 4 series, Ingenious. As well as science, you have another passion, Kat, music, and I think particularly the harp, which you play as a classical instrument and in bands. And I wonder whether you need different techniques for those two different styles of music.
You know, I've done a bit of the classical repertoire. I do, you know, weddings and functions and things like that. But for me, I really enjoy playing non-classical music. I enjoy jazz improvisation, electronic improvisation. I've played in quite a few bands. I'm still playing in a band, Sunday Driver, that does more sort of folk, Anglo-Indian influenced music. And in terms of the basic technique, it's the same. But some of the bands I've played in have quite controversially standing up while I'm playing my concert harp and jumping up and down and dancing. So I guess, yeah, that's not something you'd see a classical harpist doing.
Maybe we should. We're going to hear you play a little later, and we're also going to hear music by the harpist Ruth Wall. But first, Arnold Bax's harp quintet, written just over 100 years ago. It was an important instrument for Bax, the harp, wasn't it?
Yeah, and this particular quintet, it came to my attention because I saw my harp teacher, Alison Nichols, playing it with her ensemble, the Mobius Ensemble. And I do really love that kind of era of music, the sort of the very early 20th century music. It's just so swirly and so expressive. And the way that the harp works with the rest of the instrumentation, it's just absolutely gorgeous to me. And also, you know, seeing someone who teaches me playing and performing. And Alison was a very special teacher for me because she taught me the harp at a time when my science career was taking off. I was doing my PhD and I kind of really had to decide, did I still want music and particularly the harp, which is a big commitment to be part of my life. And, you know, yes, I wanted to carry on. I wanted to do another grade. I wanted to continue working with her. So to see her play and particularly see her perform this in a concert in the Wigmore Hall, that was really, really inspiring to me.
Thank you. Music from the Harp Quintet by Arnold Bax with the Möbius Ensemble. The harpist was Alison Nichols, and she was your teacher, wasn't she, Kat?
Yes, I was very, very lucky to learn with Alison. I've had a number of different harp teachers, a number of different music teachers over my time. I started learning the harp quite late. So I started learning the harp when I was about 13 or 14. And I saw someone play one and I was just in love. And I was like, that's it. And my parents were like, oh, no, this is going to be... It's like when a child goes, I want a pony. Like, oh, no. And they said, well, if you want to learn to play the harp, you have to get your grade 5 piano and, you know, and you have to be big enough and old enough and responsible enough to actually practice and promise that you'll learn it properly. And I never really got on with the piano and I hated my piano teachers. So it took me a very long time to get to my grade 5 piano. And then I did. And I was like, right, I've done it. And started learning the harp. And yeah, it just absolutely fell in love with it.
Transporting a harp is almost as tricky as transporting a pony. So I wonder how you do it. Do you have a station wagon, a trailer or what?
It's the question that everyone asks. They see it. And I'm quite a small woman. I'm only 5 foot tall. And they're like, how do you get it around? Have you got like a van? And so I don't have a full-size concert harp. I've got something called an orchestral harp, which is a tiny bit smaller. But actually, when I was a student, I used to get it in an Austin Metro. You can't get anything else in an Austin Metro if you've got an orchestral harp in there. And you'd get the bottom of it right up against the windscreen and then kind of the top bit and the strings out in the back. And it was that was a tight squeeze. And now I have a Mondeo, and it goes very nicely in a Mondeo.
Well, I think we should hear you playing your harp now. Tell us about this piece of music.
This is a piece that I recorded with the Heliocentrics and Mulatu Astaki, the Ethiopian jazz musician. And it was just an amazing opportunity, getting the interplay between the harp and the piano and all the musicians around us. It was a really incredible session to record. And then also we did a live performance at Coco in Camden of this. And I do really love this kind of improvisatory work. There's sort of a time when I was doing quite a lot of it, and it's really the stuff that I just love to do.
It's very hard to explain that particular joy you were talking about, that thing of smiling to somebody as they pick up a line. It's something quite unique, isn't it, the feeling of being able to do that?
And actually, listening back to that recording, it sort of reminds me of actually kind of the interesting joy when you start working with other musicians as a harpist, because many people don't really understand how the harp works, what it can do. And particularly in that sort of improvisatory jazz thing, you can do lots of really fun stuff with the pedals if you have a pedal harp, because pedals give you the opportunity to have all sorts of sharps and flats and interesting scales and arpeggios that you can kind of set up. And musicians like Alice Coltrane did this incredibly effectively. You sort of set up a few pedals in a few positions and then you just get these really weird kind of glissandi and arpeggio sounds. And it's a lot of fun. And then when you sort of bring that into the mix and bring, you know, you can do effects like banging and tapping on the soundboard of the harp. You can get harmonics. You can get sort of really quite odd things, you know, striking the strings with your tuning fork and all that kind of thing. So it's very fun to sometimes see what you can do.
Chinese New Year, Mulatu Atstatke and the Heliocentrics from the album Inspiration Information, and featuring my guest today, Kat Arney. Kat, as I said, you worked for 10 years at Cancer Research UK, and your most recent book is about cancer, the disease we tend to associate with our modern lifestyles. So why do you think that assumption is perhaps wrong?
We find examples of cancer across the entire animal kingdom, you know, birds, baboons, badgers, everywhere you look. Even incredibly simple organisms called hydra that live in the water, and they're little more than a tube with tentacles, they can get cancer. And we find evidence of cancer in dinosaur fossils, and everywhere in human civilizations where we find remains, we can find evidence of cancer. And so, you know, it was actually realizing that this is a disease that's like deeply hardwired into the biology of life. And when you understand that and you appreciate it, then it takes you in a new way of thinking about this disease, and then also thinking about how it develops in the body, why it's difficult to treat, and why we need some new strategies to approach it. So it was a really interesting journey to go on, writing the book, researching the book, talking to these amazing scientists around the world, putting it all together and then explaining it in words and examples and stories that people could really grasp.
You may think that this next question is totally off the wall, so forgive me, but I've often wondered whether nature doesn't kind of build in some form of trying to keep our numbers under control. And I sometimes wonder whether nature was almost playing a game with us.
Well, there's an interesting idea that I do actually explore in the book of the sort of the adaptation in our species, because most cases of cancer do happen in people over the age of 60. And actually, it's relatively rare under that age. And it actually suggests that there is something protective in our younger years, in our reproductive years, as you're raising your own children and then being a grandparent. But then the evolutionary mechanisms that have evolved in our species over thousands and thousands and thousands of years, they've evolved to get us through those years, but then no longer. And it's very sad, you know, as a woman kind of crashing through my 40s to feel that evolution is soon going to give up on me. So that's a really interesting opportunity to work out, well, what's protecting us in youth? What does keep us healthy, and how can we push that out and extend it into later years, where even, you know, 10, 15 years pushing cancer further and further out in our lifespan would really make a difference to people and to their families?
So you wouldn't say, if cancer is the result of inevitable genetic mutation brought on by age, that we should all drink what we want, eat what we want, and stop going to the gym?
Well, no, of course not, because, you know, it is something that you can increase the risk of. It's something you can decrease the risk of. What you want to do is not add to your mutational burden as you go through life. So don't do things that we know damage your DNA, damage your cells. And also then do actively do things that we know keep our tissues healthy, like exercising, like, you know, eating healthy foods and you know, trying to live a healthy lifestyle. And all of that does help to push this disease further and further out by keeping your tissues healthy and keeping your cells healthy and avoiding adding to your mutation. So certainly, you know, don't just give up and, you know, hit the fags and the sofa, because there's a lot you can do to try and reduce your risk of cancer through your lifetime.
You're not really a fan of more and more cancer screening, are you?
I think it is really important when you're screening people for cancer that we understand that, yes, it can detect cancers early, but it can also detect, you know, sort of pre-cancers or early cancers that actually wouldn't cause a problem in people's lifetimes. So as well as, you know, more cancer screening, and there's all sorts of exciting things coming through, like blood tests that can detect multiple different types of cancer potentially, we really need that to go hand in hand with making sure that we've got further tests to figure out, like, what are the dangerous cancers that we should find and treat, and what actually it's like, okay, this is the sort of the lumps and bumps of life that we should just be keeping an eye on rather than actively treating.
More music now, and this was written for a television series, The Mandalorian, a Star Wars spin-off. The huge proliferation of television with the streaming revolution has been really good for a certain type of composition, hasn't it?
I do think we're in a golden age of TV, but we are in a golden age of TV music. I particularly picked this piece because it's so evocative and also uses recorders really well, which you don't often hear. Even in the Star Wars universe, we see a lot of the kind of, I'm going to sound really poncy, but, you know, the Wagnerian leitmotif. Every character has their little tune and their theme, and that plays out through the TV series as well. And the Mandalorian theme is just, for me, it's absolutely iconic. And also, I really enjoy watching these series with my partner. I don't get a lot of time for watching TV. And I don't know, we cannot be the only couple that does it, but we sit and we've got like a little song that we sing along with TV theme tunes. I cannot believe we're the only people that do this. And I'm not going to sing the one that we have for The Mandalorian, but it's a really, really evocative piece of music for me.
Music by Ludwig Göransson from his score to The Mandalorian. I mentioned, Kat Arney, at the beginning that you set out to be a research scientist. Why did you abandon that ambition?
Well, it turns out I'm really clumsy and I've got a really short attention span. So working in a lab didn't really work out for me. And so for me, I was always fascinated by the science, but actually doing it was really difficult. And I'm much happier now talking about science than doing it, for sure.
Your father, Colin, also made a pretty dramatic career change when you were a teenager. He went from city banker to music teacher. Was that an example, do you think, that possibly played into your reckoning?
Yeah, so this was a really big time in my life because I was just about to go to university and my dad, he'd gone from university straight into a city bank, and after sort of 20, 23 years there, realised that this was never what he wanted to do. He is a very talented linguist, a very talented musician. And he was like, well, I always wanted to be a teacher. And my father said, I can never be a teacher. And so he retrained as a teacher. But it did mean, basically, he had three daughters. I'm about to go off to university. My sisters are teenagers. And kind of came home and told Mum that he'd quit. And that was it was a really big thing for the family. It was a really big thing for him. And the more I step back, the more I admire him more for the way that he made that choice and then has gone on to be. He was an incredibly successful music teacher and a lot happier for it.
Is this next choice, the Brahms Rhapsody in G minor, for, in particular, a family member?
Yeah, this is for my dad. So I'm sure anyone who's a musician here, you've got the piece that you can play, but you can only play like the first eight bars of it. And this is a piece I remember from my childhood. So my dad can play the first eight bars of this. And it's such an impressive piece. Da, 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 da. It's wonderful. I saw him at the weekend and I said I was going to choose this piece. And he's like, no, I can play 40 bars of it. But, you know, we've all got that piece. And this one really reminds me of him and his talent as a musician.
Well, you've asked to hear Martha Argerich, her debut recital, actually, in Germany in 1960, and I'm glad to say that she manages more than both 8 and 40 bars. What is it you like about her performance?
I just think when I listen to a few, and this one sort of captures the vibe of it, and also I quite like the German connection. So my grandmother, dad's mother, was German, and she married an Englishman, and they actually, you know, got one of the last boats out of Hamburg before the start of the Second World War. And so we've always felt this sort of deep connection to Germany, and I thought that was sort of a nice little connection as well with dad.
Marta Argerich with the Rhapsody in G minor by Brahms, a recording from 1960. And you can find details of all the music chosen by my guest today, Kat Arney, on the Private Passions web page. And if you go to BBC Sounds, you can find hundreds of previous editions of the programme, which you can download and listen to at your leisure. Kat, your book about genetics has a really intriguing title, Herding Hemingway's Cats. Explain.
So the Hemingway cats, there are the cats with six toes. So these are cats with thumbs. They're sometimes called mitten cats or thumb cats. And there's a whole kind of clowder of them that live on Ernest Hemingway's estate down in Florida. And I first encountered them when I was at a scientific conference at the Royal Society in London. And I was listening to a researcher from Edinburgh who works on these cats talking about the genetic changes that cause these cats to have thumbs. When you see a cat with a thumb, you think, well, what has gone on there? Is it a mutation in a toe gene? What is it? And realizing that it was not the gene itself, it's a piece of DNA that's basically a control switch that turns a gene on, and it's just miles and miles away from the gene itself. And realizing how little we really understand about how genes actually work, and certainly in the public domain, very little talked about it. I was like, right, I think I'm going to write a book about how our genes actually work. And went around the world, talked to all these amazing scientists. Turns out it's really complicated. And they were all pretty much like, well, when you find out, let me know. But it was a wonderful opportunity to really dig into what we understand about how our genes work, why these cats have thumbs, and all sorts of wonderful stories like that.
That brings me very nicely to a question I've often wondered about, which is the whole debate about nature versus nurture. Given what you've been talking about, I suspect I know what you feel about this. But how much of our lives do we now think are predetermined by our genes?
It's impossible to separate them. The nature versus nurture thing is something that always comes up, and every geneticist worth their salt will just go, it's nature and nurture. You can't separate the genes from the organism that they're in. You can't separate the genes and the organisms from the species, and you can't separate the species from the environment that they live in. You know, it's all about how our genes make us who we are and then how we interact with the environment around us. You know, it's absolutely impossible to separate them all. And it certainly does make the science of genetics and biology quite challenging. But it's definitely nature and nurture, not versus or either.
And of course, one can apply that to music too. If one thinks of somebody like Marta Argerich, are we talking about innate talent versus intense practice or a combination of both?
Yeah, I made a podcast recently. I present a podcast called Genetics Unzipped, and I've been waiting for years to make this episode about the genetics of music and musicality. And so I got to talk to these researchers who are trying to figure out, you know, are there genetics for music ability? Are these kind of things shared between twins? It turns out there is a genetic connection with being tone deaf, with not being able to perceive pitch at all, which is super interesting. But yes, there is some genetic connection with musical ability. There is also the kind of genetic connections with characteristics like grit and determination that mean you're going to sit there with your metronome and practice for hours and hours and hours. And I've always been fascinated by it in my family, with our sort of family history of music. You know, my father, his mother, my sister, my mother and her father as well, you know, being musical. And how that has sort of transmitted through the family. So it was really fun to actually talk to the experts and explore that a bit more.
Nina Simone next. And what number have you chosen from what is in fact her debut album?
So I've chosen a track called Little Girl Blue, which for me really showcases Nina Simone's incredible talent on the piano. And it does have quite that crossover with classical and jazz. And for me, it just is such a beautiful, delicate, fragile performance that just captures a mood that I think is incredibly beautiful.
Thank you. can you do? Sit there, count your little fingers, unhappy little girl blue. Sit there, count.
Beautiful title track from Nina Simone's debut album of 1959, Little Girl Blue, composed by Richard Rodgers and with lyrics by Lawrence Hart. Kat Arney, you've recently been working with the team led by Professor Tim Spector at King's College London, running the Zoe COVID symptom study. Tell us a little bit about that.
This has been an incredible thing to be doing during the pandemic. So I run a small science communications agency. We're called First Create the Media, and really grew out of my freelance work as a writer and a broadcaster. And in 2019, we started working with Zoe with their nutrition study and sort of turning that into a product. And then in one weekend in March, when the pandemic started, the development team there built this app. It was a really simple app. The idea was you just put in your COVID symptoms, and it was an incredibly simple way of just capturing the picture of the pandemic as it was unfolding across the UK, because there was just nothing like it. You know, the government app was nowhere close to being up and running, and it was just very simple and it just worked. And we launched, and within a week there were 1 million users, and suddenly I found me and my team, very small team, basically doing the comms for what then very quickly became the biggest COVID symptom study in the world. It's just been an amazing opportunity to feel like we're doing something. I know a lot of people do rely on the information that comes out of the Zoe COVID study, and it's been an incredible privilege to be communicating that to the public during what has been an incredibly difficult and scary time.
And I suppose also a very good example of your desire not only to explain science to the public, but to get them involved in the actual work of it.
Absolutely. I think it's a fantastic model for how we can do this kind of health research at scale. We're moving into an era where there's more and more ways of gathering data, and we really need this to understand the bigger picture and to go from the personal health to the population health, from population health back to personal health through these tools, things like apps, things like wearables, things like connecting up, you know, our health data, our health records securely and safely. That's very, very important if we're going to do this kind of thing. But to actually get insights into what keeps us healthy, what are the kinds of things that lead and contribute to health conditions and diseases. We're heading for a very, very exciting era in health research.
And there's really good news from the point of view of the number of women that are so much now at the forefront of science. I'm thinking of the vaccine, for example. But recent statistics from UCAS say that the number of women accepted into full-time undergraduate science, maths and technology courses have risen by 49% in the last 10 years. So do you think we're beginning finally to turn a corner in the quest to get more girls to study science?
I hope so. I think that you don't just need to shovel more in at the top of the funnel. You need to make sure that that funnel is wider so that more are coming out of the end. I think all round we still really need to address some of the things that mean that women leave careers in science or scientific adjacent fields. And some of that is just still stuff like childcare and caring responsibilities. We've got some wonderful talent. We've got some wonderful tools and technologies and ideas. And we should be doing everything we can to encourage that and to grow our scientific talent.
We had the Brahms for your dad, and now I think we've got something for your mum, Kat.
Yeah, so this piece I've chosen is The Swan from The Carnival of the Animals by Saint-Saëns. And this, I think, is one of the earliest pieces of music I can remember, because mum would get the record of this and put it on, and we would all crawl around on the floor pretending to be the animals. I remember being a lion. I remember being an elephant. I'm not a very elegant person, so I don't think my swan was very elegant at all. But certainly mum and also dad just instilling a love of music, and that music was something that we could interact with. And classical music, you know, it wasn't just something that you sat and listened to. It was something you could interact with. And I'm still now on the harp trying to play a solo version of The Swan. I'm practicing with my metronome and still practicing. I've nearly got there, I think. But it's just such a beautiful melody. I really love it.
Thank you.
The Swan from the Carnival of the Animals by Saint-Saëns, in an arrangement for cello and harp. We heard the cellist, Sebastian Comberti, and the harpist, Miriam Keogh. Kat, I'd like to bring you back, if I may, to the subject of cancer and evolution. That music we've just heard encapsulates a creature brought to its current state of beauty and perfection by evolution. And it's somehow hard to see how something as unpleasant as cancer fits into that natural cycle.
Cancer is an evolutionary process, and I think we sort of forget that evolution has no purpose. It has no direction. It just goes. Things evolve to adapt to the conditions in which they find themselves. And cancer is no exception. So cancer starts when cells in a tissue in the body, they pick up alterations that enable them to become fitter than the cells around them. And they have an advantage. So this is like an evolution in a microcosm.
What might taking this long view, the evolutionary view of cancer, tell us about the future of cancer treatments?
So when I was researching the book, I did uncover some people who are trying to take a more evolutionary understanding of cancer and how it grows and the pressures upon it and try and turn this into more effective treatment strategies. So then how do we devise effectively extinction strategies for this species within the body? How do you try and hit it in one way and another way and another way to actually completely get rid of all the cancer cells? So I think there is an evolution of our thinking about how cancer develops, how we treat it, the best approaches. It's certainly a work in progress, and this idea is starting to permeate through the world of cancer research and cancer treatment. But I'm certainly very hopeful that we will be moving towards more informed, more evolutionarily informed strategies in the future.
Well, we're going to end with contemporary harp music from the Cornish duo Ruth Wall and her collaborator, the composer Graham Fitkin, which takes the instrument into the realm of electronica, so absolutely what we've been talking about, Kat. Do you think we underestimate the sheer versatility of the harp?
This piece, for me, really showcases what harps can do when you bring them together in new ways with new music and new musical technologies. I was blown away when I discovered the Fitkin Wall collaboration. In particular, this song, it's performed on a Renaissance Bray harp. So this is a very old instrument, and there are little wooden pegs on each string that give it this really rough, discordant kind of bzz, bzz, bzz sound when the notes play. And it sounds like an electronic effect, but it's actually the harp itself. And I saw Ruth and Graham perform their album live in the Union Chapel in Islington when it was first out, and they combined it with these amazing visuals, and the performance was spectacular. I think Ruth had about three or four different harps, each with different sounds, you know, wire-strung harps, the Bray harp, more traditional conventional harp. And for me, that combination of electronics, of rhythm, of all the different ways a harp can sound and that you can play it, for me was just absolutely fantastic and really inspiring in my own work to see.
Well, Kat Arney, thank you so much for sharing your private passions. And let's leave you with these wonderful sounds, exploring not just the realms of the harp, but also the realms of keyboards and electronica. Kat Arney, thank you.
Thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure.
close hold from the 2007 album Fitkin Wall, featuring the harpist Ruth Wall and the contemporary composer Graham Fitkin. That was the final choice of Michael Barclay's guest on Private Passions today, Dr. Kat Arney. The episode was produced by Jane Greenwood and it was a Loftus Media production for BBC Radio 3. And you can find details of all today's music if you search for Private Passions on BBC Sounds, where you can also download hundreds of previous editions. The programme returns next Sunday at noon, when Michael Barclay will be in conversation with the musician Jarvis Cocker. BBC Radio 3 on 90 to 93 FM, digital radio and on BBC Sounds. It's 1 o'clock, time for the news, read by John Hammond. One of Britain's largest energy companies, E.ON, says about 20% of its customers are currently in fuel poverty, and that could rise to 40% when prices increase again in October. People are in fuel poverty if they spend more than a tenth of their disposable income on energy. The chief executive of E.ON, Michael Lewis, is urging the government to take what he called a very substantial action to help those worst affected. The Education Secretary, Nadeem Sahawi, says the senior civil servant who's investigated lockdown breaches at Whitehall will have complete control over what is published in her report. Questions have been asked whether pictures and WhatsApp messages gathered during the investigation will be released. People who are to be named by Sue Gray have until 5 o'clock to lodge any objections. Russian forces are stepping up their offensive in eastern Ukraine as they try to seize more territory. A local official said residential areas in the city of Severodonetsk were being shelled and an important bridge had been destroyed. The government in Kiev says it won't agree to a ceasefire with Russia that involves giving up territory. A presidential adviser said that making concessions would encourage Moscow to attack again later. The UK Health Security Agency says more cases of monkeypox are being identified on a daily basis. The rare viral infection associated with West Africa had been detected in Europe, the US, Canada and Australia. Israel and Switzerland are the latest countries to confirm cases. 20 people are known to have been infected in the UK, and the figure could rise tomorrow when fresh data is to be released. 22 people killed in the Manchester Arena bombing are being remembered on the fifth anniversary of the attack at the Ariana Grande concert. Church bells will toll at 10:31 tonight, the time the bomb was detonated. The Australian Labour Party, which came first in yesterday's election, says its leader, Anthony Albanese, will be sworn in as Prime Minister tomorrow. Some members of the Cabinet will be appointed, although the party is just short of an outright majority. Women television presenters in Afghanistan, who yesterday largely ignored an order from the Taliban to cover their faces, have now appeared on air with veils. The compliance followed a warning from the Taliban Ministry of Vice and Virtue that the order was non-negotiable. And the weather. It'll be cloudy with rain in parts of Northern Ireland and Scotland and light showers in areas of Wales and Northern England, while Southern England will have long sunny spells. BBC News and Weather at 2 minutes past one.
Ralph Vaughan Williams, countryman and radical, serviceman and activist, folk song collector and symphonist.
I think he's one of the most important 20th century symphonists.
To celebrate his 150th anniversary year, I'm joined by experts to build up a comprehensive portrait of a composer who's left an indelible mark on British music.
But I really do believe that Vaughan Williams' music is in fact more relevant than ever.
See Vaughan Williams in a